You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show. Hey, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. This month, Deborah and I are going to be sharing survivor stories, starting with Grace's story today, and then in a couple of weeks, I'll be sharing my story. But Grace's episode needs a little bit of context. She was raised in what you might consider a fringe Christian community, and she asked us to protect her identity. So there are a couple of spots in the episode that might feel a little choppy, but it's in service to protecting her identity. Now, I was raised in a mainstream church, but our stories share a lot of commonalities. For example, we were both raised in authoritarian Christian communities and experienced what I would consider excessive punishment. We both experienced strict gender roles. Those are just a few of the things that our stories share in common. The other reason that Deborah and I thought that these stories would pair well together is that Grace is only 5 years out of her church. So she's really early on in her deconstruction journey, whereas I've been at it for several decades, and so my spiritual transformation story has a much fuller, richer arc, but of course I've been at it a lot longer. The next time we feature survivor stories, we'll do so with men's stories, because we understand that men's stories have particularities that are different from our own. So just wanted to provide that for context, and now on to the show. Our guest today is Grace. And we're not using her full name to protect her identity. Grace was raised in the Institute of Basic Life Principles and left when she was 17 years old. She's a senior in college now, majoring in human health and biology. And for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the Institute of Basic Life Principles, it's a religious organization founded in 1961 that is dedicated to giving clear instruction and training on how to find success by following God's principles found in Scripture, which is accomplished primarily through seminars, educational programs, literature, and the operation of centers to facilitate training. In researching the Institute, we learn that it is described as a strict religious community that pushes an authoritarian patriarchal theology, and that it adheres to rigid gender roles where males are the head of the family and females are expected to obey. There are strict dress and conduct codes and lots of other rules. One critic described the Institute as cult-like because of its charismatic leadership, authoritarian control, isolation of members, severe punishments, and demand for absolute and blind loyalty. And if you're tempted to dismiss this community as simply a fringe group based on this brief description, we've learned that it has millions of followers around the world, and its supporters have included such high-profile conservatives as the Duggar family of the reality TV show 19 Kids and Counting, former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate Mike Huckabee, former Alaska governor and vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin, and former Texas governor and U.S. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry. And I experienced similar dynamics in the Southern Baptist churches in which I grew up. So thank you for being here with us today, Grace. We're so grateful. Thank you and welcome.
I'm excited to be here too.
Well, we are very, very excited to have you. And the first thing we want to know is the description that Robin just said out loud. Is that an accurate description of the Institute?
Yeah, you knew a couple more things than I did. And when I'm asked about it, I always say it started in the 70s with like stadium tours. I didn't realize that it started in the 60s, which anyways, but yeah. So it also runs in tandem with an organization called Quiverful. I don't know if you guys know anything about Quiverful. And so they run really, really close together. And so I think Quiverful is considered a semi-cult by the government. But you use some words that, like, I always bounce back and forth between. I never know whether to call it, I was raised in a religious cult, or I was raised in a religious community, because it's really hard to, like, differentiate the two. But it was pretty accurate. A lot of really strict rules, strict modesty codes. And then a lot of, one of the things that I don't think was mentioned a ton was you're cut off from, like, a lot of the world. Like, you're not really allowed to use media or the internet or anything like that. And then every morning you're supposed to be doing, like, these wisdom booklet things, which were, like, the worst.
Tell us a little bit about the wisdom booklets. I've never heard of that.
Oh, okay. So they're, like, I guess they're, like, technically optional, but, like, they're not optional. You know what I mean? If you want to be a good religious family, then your father leads you in worship in the morning. And so we'd have to go through them. And, like, they just tell us stuff like how to stay modest, or, like, a lot of, like, information on how to be, like, a good salt of the earth Christian. That's what they said a lot. And then near the end, when Gottfried was actually, like, molesting people, he made one that was, like, literally about how you're not supposed to bear witness against, like, your leaders to other leaders, because it sows dissent or something. And so, like, he was literally, like, trying to protect himself, and, like, was, like, making up all this, like, random bull crap about, like, not, like, souring the church. I forget what the exact words are, but I remember those being thrown around there somewhere. So we had to do them every morning, and then we would keep them in boxes. So we'd have them from, like, years back, and, like, they'd be in, like, a storage container in our basement for, like, forever.
You would revisit them?
I think you were supposed to, but, like, my family was super dysfunctional near the end. My parents are actually no longer together. It kind of ended up badly. Turns out my dad joined the cult to try to pray the gay away, which didn't really work.
Ah, gotcha.
Yeah, so he's kind of doing his own thing now. Sorry, that's...
That's okay. No, and actually, there are several things that I definitely want to follow up on. First of all, Gother, for people who don't know, is the man who started the Institute, right? He's the kind of the leader. The other thing is I, in my research, I am familiar with what you're talking about, those morning readings, because I listened to a video. You know, I went to the website, the Institute's website, and listened to a video about it. And the other thing I did was they had the biblical illustrated calendar that people look through every day. And I just randomly picked one, and it was responsibility from January 2020. And some of the things for some of the kind of the reminders for the month overall are things like know my roles, know my duty and do my duty, complete my tasks. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I mean, so a couple of others, remember that he is watching, confess my sins. And we just talked last week with somebody about, I think it was last week, right? The interview mm-hmm. with David Hayward, where we're talking about the pressure for public confession of your sins and just, you know, the pressures around that. And so anyway, there's the curriculum is pretty stringent. Like, you're expected to do those things, right? Part of your daily, they're part of your daily activity.
Yeah. And then you're not going to school either, because homeschooling is a really big part of it. So they'll supplement more education materials into that, which is pretty crazy. You don't really learn much.
So one of the questions that we were wondering about is the Institute considered a church? Would you call it a church? Or is it more of an organization?
Or a community.
Or a community.
I would use the word community. It's almost, I'm going to use a term they love. I don't know if you've seen this in your research, but it's an umbrella.
Yes, I did see that, an umbrella. Mm-hmm. Actually, I printed a copy of that umbrella.
Oh, I saw a really funny one with a Josh Duggar, but instead of God, it says third party custodian.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, that's not me. I just, you know.
This umbrella, is this the right one?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Yeah. So for our listeners, it's a picture of an umbrella, and there's a top umbrella and sort of a bottom umbrella. And the top umbrella has husband written across it, and the bottom umbrella has wife. And the husband's responsibilities are to protect the family and provide for the family, and the wife's responsibilities are to manage the children in the home.
Did you live in the community in some sort of compound, or is it more loosely organized than that?
So it's more loosely organized. Like, there are areas in like cities that have like a stronger congregation of us. So basically I lived in a community where most of us were members of the organization. There wasn't a compound. Most of my neighbors and friends, in fact, I could say pretty much all my friends were part of the organization itself. And then our church, we bounced around churches a little bit, actually, because I kept getting sick because none of the kids were vaccinated. And I was, my parents vaccinated us, which was really, really, really against the grain. And that's one of the things I'm really grateful for.
So I know that there are reasons why you left at 17. How much of those had to do with the gender role expectations? What were the gender role expectations? Like, what were you, what was expected of you as a young woman and a woman in the church?
Yeah. So, as a young woman, like modesty is a really big one, but it's not like just like keep your body covered. Like you're not supposed to wear bright clothes or like things that will draw attention away from you, like your countenance. So like we had to like cover from like here and like to like our below our knees. Like if you see me in bathing suits from that time, like I'm covered from here to my ankles. And like you're most of the time at the Institute, like you're supposed to keep your sleeves below your elbow. And then stuff like that. And then like even in pajamas, it's part of it. Like most of the time you're supposed to wear skirts. There was a time where I only wore skirts, but then we could wear some loose fitting pants, but like leggings and shorts were like off the table. If we wore shorts, they like went below our knee, which was not very cute.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. I know just what you mean. Yep.
Yeah. Very ugly. I love wearing shorts now, and bathing suits. So stuff like that. And then like the way you behave, like you're not supposed to be around young men alone. I can probably count on my hand the number of times that happened, throughout my childhood. And then like a lot of expectations of modesty, even within your family. Like I remember one time I came downstairs and my bedroom didn't have like heat or air conditioning most of the time. Like sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. And so it was very, very hot. So I was sleeping in sleep shorts and a tank top, which I felt like was appropriate for the weather. And I kind of knew it was going to be a risk, but I decided to go down to get water in my pajamas. And while I was down there, my mother came up to me and she was like, she found me. And she was like, you're going to cause your father and your brothers to lust after your body. Like, you cannot come downstairs dressed like that. And so it was like, it was deeper than just like, don't let men outside your family see it. It was like, your brothers and your dad are going to see your 12-year-old little clavicles and be like, whoa, that's a woman right there. We never did. But molestation was like a huge issue. And then they would blame it on the little girls not being able to like, I remember one, it was like, she couldn't keep her diaper covered. And it was just too much for me. One of the testimonies. Yeah, no, I could find it and send you the link afterwards. But stuff like that was like really common. And then like, I remember one time when I was at the conference, Bill Gothard actually came down to like our little girl's room. And he was like, it's your job as a young woman to encourage your brothers and tell them that they're strong and you feel safe around them because they're the future leaders of tomorrow. And it's your job to encourage them. You're encouragers. That's your job. And I remember thinking like, that's dumb. What if I want to be a future leader? My brothers are so stupid. Of course, they were like training with like, they have like a militia thing where like they train young boys.
What does that look like? Do you know what that looks like? What the training for young boys is like?
So it starts with like when you're like around 11 or 12, I think. And like you'll go for like a week during conference and like they'll train you like it's the military. And then after that, you can sign up for more. And like you can go work for them. And like it's called Alert Cadets. Hidden. They have like kind of one for girls called Step, but like you just cook for the Alert Cadets basically. Some walking, but that's about it. And then I don't really know what else they do just because.
You didn't go through it.
I didn't. I would hear them singing outside, but that was about it.
Grace, you alluded to the, lack of contact with boys and young men. That's forbidden pretty much, right?
Yeah.
So when we were researching this, we read that your parents on both sides, a boy side and a girl side, pick the mate, you, and then as you're growing up, they monitor all of this until you get to where you become married or engaged or whatever it is. Tell us what that looks like.
Well, it looks different for everyone. Yeah, like some people would just be like, this is the person you're going to marry. It's betrothal. I remember one time at conference, like this pastor came up to my parents and he had seen my older sister and he was like, she is perfect for my son, Chuck. And my parents were like, what an honor. He is, because he was speaking at the conference. It was like, woohoo, you know? And my sister at the time was probably 19 and she was cool. I love my older sister. Yeah, they tried to set them up, but it didn't work out, which is great because my sister kind of wanted out anyways. And I don't think she would have gotten out if she married the pastor's son. But like, that's how it's expected to work. Like people come up to you and be like, your daughter, or like sometimes the son will be like, I saw this woman and she's beautiful. And he'll talk to like the parents before he talks to
the girl. Really the men get to choose the women.
You can just say no, but you don't get to choose.
Got it. Well, you did leave at 17. Mm-hmm. What were some of the reasons why you left?
Well, a couple. There was just a lot of hypocrisy, and a lot of it had to do with my home life. My father struggled with substance abuse a lot, and so that was really, really hard, and my mom was handicapped. And so me and my sister were basically like helping run the house and raise my younger brother. And at that point, my older brother and sister had left, and they'd been pretty vocal about their issues with it. It was around that time that the molestation issues with Gothard came out. And I kind of just knew that I had to get out in that, like, it was just going to be, there was no good end to the story with me involved in the organization, which is interesting because I remember as a little girl, like, walking down the hallways and being excited to be with one of the big girls who wore, like, the navy blue shirts, you know? I never got to be one of those big girls. But, yeah, I think I just kind of, it wasn't even that I realized everything that they said was wrong. I just knew that there were too many issues to remain attached to it. I had sat down with my mom once and was like, because I found out that Bill Gothard's brother got kicked out in the 70s for molesting a very young girl. And she was like, and I was like, they should have dealt with it then and like talked about it openly. And she just said, things were different back then. And then I was like, what about now? And she said, you would still listen to King David, even though he killed Bathsheba's husband and was a sinner. And in my head, I was like, well, King David Bill Gothard was anointed by God. And then I don't know. I think those are like the final straws for me. And then I wasn't really a believer growing up. I got saved when I was 16 into what I consider to be like the real Jesus. And that was also a really big separating point for me because like nothing that I read in the Bible and nothing that I was experiencing in my relationship with Christ consistent with what I was seeing in the teachings, because I'd always hated it. Like I'd always been like really pissed about it.
Did you get saved in a different church?
Yeah, there was a really awesome churchwoman and she just, I don't know. A lot of it was just like my own personal journey, but there were a lot of people who loved me well. And it was the first time that I'd seen like genuine love and acceptance from anybody. So that pretty much changed my life.
So you left at 17. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? How did you separate?
Well, thankfully my older two siblings had done it before me. Namely my older brother. He had made a really big deal when he left. And like, he took a lot of the heat. And at that point, my mom was so handicapped that I was doing most of this around the house. And I ended up being like, hey, you have to choose between me or my dad. And we got him out of the house, which is one of like the greatest things she's ever done for me. And then from there, we stayed for like another couple months and I left like 3 months after I turned 18. And so separating was less about separating from the church and like separating entirely from the community that I grew up with. Like I still would have people that would talk to me if I went back there, but they would consider me like a brazen whore and a weirdo. I used to say this about other people who do what I do. They'd be like, ah, she wears a bikini. She went off the deep end. She went to college and
she got brainwashed and fell. In my community, it was, she's off the straight and narrow path. Yeah. And I heard the same things, Grace. Like I remember going to our big church camp, Falls Creek, for Southern Baptists. Of course, the boys and the girls swam at different times. But walking to and from the pool, you had to be completely covered. And then, of course, there were barriers up so that, you know, we couldn't see each other swimming because, of course, they couldn't see our bodies. And I also experienced what you did about higher education. Not from the standpoint of like, don't go, but the expectations from my family was that I would only learn this one thing, which was my dad always wanted me to be a medical doctor. Ha ha. I ended up being a doctor of philosophy instead. But Like, that was okay, but he didn't want me to learn anything that could potentially, you know, influence my thinking and my walk and all of that stuff. So they really did consider me, what's the word? They considered me brainwashed. Like, I got to college and I got brainwashed. Yeah. So back to your dad for a minute. Well, I actually have two follow-up questions. One is, you partially answered it, but like, when you didn't agree with one of the church's teachings or practices, could you push back? Could you like, yeah, you're shaking your head no. What would be the consequence if you attempted to do that?
Well, it kind of depended. I remember one time I wrote like this paper on what I thought the church looked like from the outside, because I was a very curious child and I kind of was like, this doesn't seem very like realistic. And so I wrote like this whole letter about like what this would look like to an outside, like commentate, like what would this look like? And my mom found it and she like came to me and she's like, if your brothers and sisters are led away from Christ because of this, then you will be responsible for sending them to hell before God. And then they were burned. And then afterwards I was like weeping and my older brother came up to me and he like put his hand on my shoulder and he was like, never stop bastards.
That's so great. Yeah.
Yeah. At that point he had left, but he wasn't really allowed to talk to us about it very much. Mm-hmm.
What about your dad? You talked about your dad having substance abuse problems. Was that frowned upon in the church? Did they attempt to support him?
So it was weird. A lot of it was like very hush hush. And the issues like that are actually a lot more prevalent than you'd think. Although, so like substance abuse, no matter what it is, and pornography are both considered like addictions within the organization. And those are both like on the same level of bad, which like they're not, you know. I think like, without a doubt, the porn industry has issues, but like, I think being like, oh, if you're addicted to porn, it's the same amount of like devastation to a family as it is when you're addicted to like alcohol or narcotics or whatever it is that you're struggling with. And so they were all like lumped together. And I never got to go to the men's meetings. They all had like special times. Like, you did not go to the men's meetings, but I think that they dealt with it like that. And my dad went to rehab a couple times. But I wasn't allowed to tell any of my friends about it. Like, my mom would come sit me down and be like, if you tell anybody what's going on or what's happening, then your father will lose his job and will be homeless. You know, people put in foster care. So I was terrified to like let anybody know what was happening. And at the same time, I also didn't really have the vocabulary to explain what was going on. That was a really big thing. Like, I couldn't, like, at the time, I'd try to explain things that were happening at my house to, like, people, even at, like, 16, 17. I'd be trying to explain to, like, the counselor that I was going to what was going on. Like, I'd be like, this is happening. And, like, the words that I were using were not right to describe the situation because I had not been empowered to use words to describe the situation.
Well, that kind of begs the question. Talking about your dad's experience and how what the community did or didn't do with regard to him, what did they do or what would they have done to a woman with the same kind of problem?
I don't know. My guess is it probably would have been handled by the husband first. The issue there is that like you're assuming that the woman can just go out and get alcohol, which sounds bad, but like women are a lot more closely monitored than men. I think you can see in like comparison to like the Josh Duggar scandal, which is a skeez, but what, like she's under like subjugation of her husband. And so like if a woman went out and bought things, like he'd be able to see on the receipts if she was going to get narcotics, he would like probably put a stop to it. And then from there, they'd go to like the community if it kept getting worse. But I've never heard of it happening with a woman. And I think, which it's not, I don't have the scientific evidence to back it up. My intuition is that it would be dealt with by her and then it would go to the church and then so on. But women have no power over men, and my dad could just buy or get prescriptions for whatever he wanted outside of the house. And then my parents were specifically, especially independent in some ways than the rest of the community was. So I think that also gave him some leeway. And then I don't really know. I've never heard of it happening with a woman. I think that's probably why. Yeah, it's a really big issue with the men. There's always like secret addictions. Like half the time it's porn, and then like half the time it's like hardcore drugs.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Well, the porn doesn't surprise me, simply because, and I know Deborah has heard me share this before, but the president of the Religious Studies Student Body here at the university that we work at was asked one time by one of the faculty members, what's the biggest problem that students are struggling with? And she expected to hear him say alcohol, and he said pornography. So it's, yeah, that's, I was surprised to hear that as well. So, and I sort of think that that's probably a problem because there's no healthy sexual education within a lot of church communities. And so it pops up in, you know, dysfunctional ways, and pornography is accessible.
Yeah.
Against the rules, but accessible, right? And so
it's crazy. And guys know more than girls do too. Like, my sister got married when she was 20, and my mom didn't sit her down to tell her what like sex was until the night before our wedding. And at that point, she'd already been like out enough, like that her boyfriend had like kind of been like, hey, this is what you can expect when we get married. And like, these are the basics. Her first kiss story is like a disaster.
You've got this beautiful long blonde hair.
Mm-hmm.
And so have you kept it long like this since when you were in the church, or did you grow it? I'm asking because I'm thinking about the sort of the dress codes or the, like, I would call that, you know, like what's expected in terms of your, in my terms, my Christian femininity. What were the expectations? What were some of the expectations in your neck of the woods?
Well, our hair was kept long, actually. So it's been 5-6 years since I've left, and this is the first time I've grown it out since then. I've kept it about this short. And then I started growing it out over quarantine, and I like it long, but I did not want to like it long just because it's all I'd ever had. But now I know I like it long because I like it long. So I kept it really short for a while, and I dyed it like pink and purple, stuff like that, you know? I also do. And
do your people know that you have a tattoo? No.
One of my other friends, it's really bad because this is a serious epidemic, but I was like, I don't really care what they think about me. And so she was like, oh, I'm just going to tell them that you've had 11 abortions and that you smoke crack every day. And so I think some of them genuinely think that that's true. I'm not sure how far that rumor spread. I also don't really care because I'm not going back, mm-hmm. which that's really embarrassing. I'm not sure if she actually like, anyways, so if they knew about that tattoo, I'm sure it wouldn't surprise them due to the fact that they think that I've done those things, which I haven't. And they're both serious topics that should be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sorry, that's like really an inappropriate thing to joke about, but it was one of the things that was said to me.
No, it's okay. Yeah.
It shows that contrast. Your before and after contrast.
Yeah. I think that I put my tattoos somewhere. I have three. They're all pretty hidden for the most part. I think the thing that would get me in the most trouble wouldn't be the tattoos. It would be like the fact that I wear short shorts, or I'll show cleavage sometimes. I wear spaghetti straps. I've kissed a boy before marriage. I've kissed more than one boy before marriage. Oof, that's a big no-no. Stuff like that. I think would be the most jarring for people to learn. Like, if I was seeing myself at the age of 12, I'd be like, whoa, like, you're not making good choices, which is funny because I feel like I am. Yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel about, I just know that sometimes our journey when we leave, like, we know we have to leave, and we leave and we still feel guilty about the things that we're leaving. There's like this internal process that has to happen for us to be okay with where we are on this new part of our journey. And that journey for me took a long time. You've come farther faster than I did, which is, I'm really happy for you on that. But how has that part been? Like, the leaving part is one part of it, and then the feeling okay with that is another part of it. How are you with that?
Well, I mean, it's been a slow journey. The first night I left, I lived in an apartment with like 11 other Christian girls to go to a Bible college, which was like crazy. And that night, one of them said that like she'd like let her boyfriend touch her butt before, and I had to call my brother crying because I was astonished that like a Christian woman would like let a man like touch her butt. Like, I was like literally sobbing on the floor, being like, "Does it get any easier?" And like my brother was like, "Yeah, but like you gotta give it time." And I think he was just trying to calm me down because, like, to me, it was like, this world is so scary. People let people touch their butts. Like, what? So, like, obviously, like, a lot of intense opinions on, like, sexuality and sex. And I think sexuality and, like, things like alcohol and, like, marijuana, and then clothing were like the hardest to like try to comprehend as like just like a normal person. I personally, just because there's substance abuse in my participate, but they're not necessarily wrong. And so like coming to that like idea was like challenging. Clothing came a little easier. It still was a really long process. Like it took me a year to wear leggings for the first time. And then crop tops took another 2 or 3. And then now I pretty much wear whatever I want. And then experiencing physical intimacy is probably the hardest one for me, which I have a really great partner right now. And that makes it a lot easier to like communicate like, hey, I'm comfortable with this. I'm not comfortable with this. And like, if I'm feeling guilty over something, we'll sit down and we'll talk about it and communicate about like, how do we want to approach this? Then how can we make this respectful for both of us? And like trying to understand that like feeling guilty all the time isn't normal. And so stuff like that, like has been challenging, or like just making choices. Even like now it's been like 5 years. Like I just realized like the other day that I can just go out to eat when I want. I can just choose to do something like that for myself. And I do it a lot. I got a McDonald's sandwich today because today was my first day at work, my new job. And on the way home, I got like a drink and a sandwich. And I was like, doing what I want.
Have to ask anyone.
I can just choose to do things that I want to do when I want to do it. And so that's pretty cool. I can just get in my car and drive somewhere. Yeah, that was also the hardest thing at first too, was just like the amount of options that I had. Like I'd never really been able to watch TV like I wanted, like, and so I could watch TV, and that was crazy. I don't know, sorry, I feel like I'm talking too much.
No, you're not. This is so interesting.
I do have a question though. As you're talking about all of these newfound freedoms over the past few years and sort of finding your way, what is your relationship now with your family, with your mother, your younger siblings, your dad?
So my mom and I are friends. We'll talk on the phone. She'll come visit me. She chose me over my dad that day. And so for me, that was like something that I will never forget, because it's not something that is usually done where I come from. And she knew that I would mean sacrificing her marriage. And she's, you know, I don't know, I'm really grateful for that. It kept my siblings together, and it was a really scary thing for her to do, and she did it. Basically, like around the time that I left, my dad got in trouble with like the law for driving under the influence, and he started texting the church that me and my siblings went to, being like, the wrath of God is going to pour down upon you from turning my children from me. And like our house got like raided by like the FBI and stuff. After that, me and my dad just like haven't ever really reconnected. He also like was really suicidal during my last few years with him. And that was really hard, because like, I could come home and see if he'd killed himself. And like that really was really traumatic. And then about 7 months ago, I want to say he started to like reintegrate into our lives. Like he'll pop in and out and like we'll be friendly, but it's like, I don't know, it's complicated.
Distant friendly.
Yeah. And then like he like disowned us all when like Trump got elected. I mean, when Trump lost the election. And then like he was threatening my brother similarly to how he was threatening the church. And that was really scary. And since then, like it's been not great between us. I saw him briefly, but we kind of just see each other in passing. I know that he wants to have a relationship with me, but I just don't really feel ready for one. I'm scared he's going to hear this and get mad at me too, but he like terrifies me. And it's not even that he's a terrible person. He's just mentally ill, and like the years of trauma and like abuse like got to him too. And like I can't imagine growing up as like a young gay man in like the 60s, 70s in the rural south, and then like deeply religious rural south. Like what the hell? Like he probably has BP 1 or 2. So he'll go through cycles of being like really positive. And like, those are such serious issues not to deal with, that they can really impact you as you get older. And in themselves, it's not necessarily his fault. It's just, it would have been wonderful if he had been able to take responsibility, or others around him had taken responsibility to get him treatment.
Is he still part of the church?
No, he actually came gay. It was a really big step for him, and it's kind of made some things better. He's a boyfriend now.
And you can't be gay and be part of the church. Mm-hmm. Right.
No. Yeah. Well, he'll say that he's like religious, but like the weird stuff that he believes, like it's like not like new agey. It's like just kind of whack. And I think it's just like, you know, years of substance abuse and like, yeah, like really weird, really weird.
I think it's amazing that you can view him with that much compassion for his own struggles and how that contributes to who he is. It still doesn't mean he should have access to you, but I think it's amazing that you can view him with that much compassion.
Yeah, I think that that's important to realize that like I can see myself in him and I can see myself in my mother. And like, if I want to end up in a way that I'm not going to look back at my life and regret the choices that I've made, then I need to be aware that I am just as capable of these as they are, I guess. And so that's been a big part of it, making sure that I'm making choices that'll set me up for success, like going to therapy, getting counseling. I had a really rough mental health week in March, and I took off school and went to my primary care physician to got diagnosed with PTSD and like took care of it like immediately, because I think that doing stuff like that is a huge priority. And like addressing fears and like coming forward and talking about it. Like, this is really scary for me. I like talking about it with my friends sometimes, but like this was published and like my father or like my community could find it and like figure out who I am. And like, I'm scared for that. But I think that there's so many stories like mine and like my brothers and sisters, and that they need to be told, because people won't associate, you know, what happened to us with like how horrible it really was. And there were so many things that could have been worse, but like, I see like my brother's struggle every day with like, just like the trauma from it all.
The legacy of it. What would you say, and you have already said quite a bit, but just come wrapping back around it a little bit, what were the hardest parts? What were the parts that were, I guess, the most traumatizing?
So it kind of cuts back and forth between like the issues that my father had with substances and just like the fact that my parents didn't really get along. A lot of the guilt and shame was a really big thing for me. Like, I kept a diary outlining my sins to give to Bill Gothard when I was really little, which is crazy now. But like, then I thought that if he looked at it, like he would forgive me and I'd be extra saved, because I was terrified that I wasn't really saved.
Yeah.
And I thought that the end times were coming. And I have OCD, but as a child, I wasn't diagnosed. And so I would stay up for hours at night being afraid that like people were going to bomb us, like nuclear weapons, or like that the Lord was going to come, it was going to be the rapture, and like I was not going to be taken.
You're going to be left behind.
Yeah. And like, I wasn't saved and I was going to go to hell. I would literally like be up to like 3 or 4. Like, I would sleep like only a few hours because I was just terrified all the time. And then once everybody was in bed, like I'd go from bed to bed to make sure all my siblings were okay. And then I'd crawl and curl up on the floor in my parents' bedroom. So I thought I'd be safer there, and I'd wake up before they would, so I could go back up to my bedroom and wait for morning. Stuff like that was really, really horrible. And then just like being cut off from like the rest of the world, I think was hard. A lot of my speech patterns are really weird. And so are my siblings, because we didn't really grow up. And like, I don't know if you've noticed, it hasn't been too bad today, but I mispronounce a lot of words, and idioms are just really bad in general. My boyfriend laughs at those ones. I said creme de la resistance the other day, and he hasn't let that one go because it was particularly rough. But stuff like that, and then traumatic, yeah. Just like my parents trying to cope with like their own issues without access to a good amount of help.
Yeah. And Grace, what you're describing, I completely appreciate, because it really does feel like being dropped, you know, sort of on a new planet, and you don't know the terrain and you don't know the language and the people are kind of strange, and just trying to navigate all of that can be really scary. The word that I use a lot in my own journey is, when I decided to leave, I felt unmoored, like just kind of adrift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Free falling. I would like call it free falling. Like, I felt like I had no idea what up and down was. I had no idea how to talk like normal. The food was different. The way that I dressed set me apart. Like, I forget now that I pass. Because like, I'll be like, oh, you can't tell that like I grew up weird. But like, I like for the first while of a conversation, like people won't know. And like, that's really weird. I never felt like that would happen. But now it is happening more. So
reached a milestone there, huh?
Yeah. I only have one dress that I've made in my closet. It's really cute though.
So you've mentioned some of the people who have helped you, your older siblings who sort of got out before you. What else has been helpful in your, you know, sort of journey out?
Television.
Has it?
My brother would say the same. Yeah, my little one. YouTube and TV. And then I've had some really awesome friends. My first friend when I went to Bible school, she was really awesome. And she like took me shopping and like helped me buy. Like she was like, every woman needs to own adult underwear. And so she like took me to like stores and like she took me to movie theaters. And I'd been to like movie theaters before, but I could go see whatever I wanted. She let me eat candy. Like I would eat candy and just like throw up because I'd never had that much candy. I was 18.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Like I remember this guy got me Sour Punch straws once and I just like barf blew everywhere. But stuff like that, she like was really wonderful with that. And then I had a couple other friendships like that. And then I started working more and that was kind of a big thing for me. And then yeah, I would say like I had a few select friendships that like really pushed me further. I had church community that really provided nourishment. I would say like one of the biggest things in my journey, I don't think I would have made it out if I hadn't been saved. And I know a lot of people say stuff like that, but like I just genuinely don't think I would have. If I didn't have like that, like there would be no purpose, I guess. I didn't really like it, but I went. I was too scared to not go to church because I'd go to hell, you know?
That fear of hell is so real. People underestimate it. And Grace, when I left my church, I mean, I was probably out 10 years and I didn't believe in it in the way that I did when I, you know, used to attend my church. But my body still reacted to those threats. Even though I didn't hold the belief anymore, my body would still like react to, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want to go to hell. Everything was like, I don't want to go to hell.
It like makes me so sad because like the core of like the gospel message is like, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever, you know, like that verse that we all learned.
Yeah.
It's about like, God loved you so much that he decided that he was going to sacrifice himself to like cover your, sorry, my voice is like, to cover your sins. And like, it's not about like you feeling like this overwhelming guilt and shame anymore. It's about like this release from guilt, from shame. And it's about loving one another. And like, you know, God like straight up ate with, like Jesus like ate with prostitutes, like, you know? And so it's like really frustrating to like have grown up like how I grew up and like reading the scriptures now and reading the gospels now and being like, what the heck? Like, what?
Yeah.
You know, where does it say the things that you taught me? It doesn't check out.
Yeah. It's what is, I, you know, I think it, I often think it's what's emphasized because I always felt like the verses that were emphasized when I was growing up were they were so fear-based. Like it was all this stuff to scare you into, you know, behaving a certain way or believing a certain way versus like coming at it from love and wanting to move toward God, a loving God. It was like trying to move away from a scary God, a wrathful God. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is funny because it's either like the really fearful verses or it's Proverbs 31.
Right. And for people who don't know Proverbs 31, tell us what it is, Grace.
Ooh, I would recite it all, but I don't think we have the time. It is about being a godly, exemplary woman and how to be like a good. And it's like it's a verse actually that I think shows a lot of liberation for women, like the woman in Proverbs 31 owns a business, she makes her own money, she provides for her family, she's industrious, but it's taken out of context to be like, as a woman, like you should be doing these things godly, like you will be a gem into your husband's crown.
Yes, we got that Bible verse on, I was just telling Deborah about this the other day, that was passed out in our churches on Mother's Day, as a bookmark. There you go. Remember.
Him and your husband's crown.
That's it. That's the one. It's sort of cherry picked out of the rest of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit better, you know?
Yeah. I want to ask you about one more thing. I know we only have about 5 minutes left, but in our research, we came across, ironically, an organization called Recovering Grace. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah, I've read some of it and we can go over too. Like, I'm not in a rush. Like,
Okay.
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. So I found it very heartening. And for our listeners, it's an online community where people who have been abused, right, within the community's It's like a forum for them to share their stories. Is that fair? Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I think it's a place where community members go to, like, begin expressing some of the things that happened. It's hard to explain what happened to people who have never been through it.
Yes. Because they, do you fear that they wouldn't believe it?
All the time. Yeah. Like, I'm going to tell my life story to somebody and they're going to be like, that's bull. Like, that's baloney. Like, I don't believe any of that. And so, like, I'm always afraid that when I tell people about my life, that they're going to think I'm lying about something. Cause it just seems so weird. And I did an interview. Like, I started writing about it for the first time this semester. Cause I think this semester I've just come to the realization that, like, somebody needs to know what happened. But basically, like, I was talking to my brothers about it. And he was like, the thing that surprised me the most when leaving was that nobody else had a story like mine. I thought that I wouldn't be so alone, but nobody knows how isolating it was and nobody understands what it was like.
Right. Right. And then you get out and you find that there are actually people who can relate to you because it's their story too.
Yeah.
But the system keeps you separated. Mm-hmm. Right? We're not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. And I don't know. I wish that I'd known somebody else had done it when I left. Like, nobody, I was alone.
Yeah.
It was hard. I have my siblings and that was awesome, but I can't imagine how hard it was for them.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have anybody.
Yeah. It's, well, and I love that you're sharing your story, even if it's anonymously. It's still, I absolutely believe that your story will help people because there'll be people like you who hear it and maybe not feel so alone. You talk about that. I felt the same loneliness. It's like, you want to tell it. And I loved what you said about not having the language. That's something that I talk about a lot. We don't have the language because we've never been given the language. Yeah.
It was further than just the religious stuff. Like, most of the kids I know growing up were, like, severely abused, but, like, they're not given the language to, like, explain what's happening to them. Like, they'll be like, yeah, my mom yells at me a lot, or I get disciplined a lot. And that translates to, like, I get, like, the crap beaten out of me for, like, not washing all the plates. Sometimes my head gets held down into the dishes when I don't clean them fast enough. Stuff like that. And, like, there's just no communication for it because, like, the kids are so segregated from the rest of the world. And it's really awful.
Yeah, because who are they going to tell? Other people in the same situation, right? Yeah.
I remember being like 7 or 8, or probably closer to 9 or 10, because we joined when I was about 6 or somewhere in there. And, like, my siblings were making fun of kids who didn't get, like, hit. They'd be like, yeah, like, in California, parents aren't allowed to hit their kids. And, like, we were like, they must be so naughty then. And stuff like that, which is crazy. And, like, I know that some people are, like, fine with spanking too. And, like, we got spanked a lot. But, ooh.
But it goes a little bit beyond that.
Yeah, no. Yeah. It's like, you'll just, there was, like, this special tool that they would buy. It was called a cat's paw. It was modeled after, like, a cat of nine tails. And it would, like, kind of, it was, oof. It was made out of nylon and it hurt. It hurt so bad. And then, like, it would be, like, really intense punishments in general. But, and then there's just, like, a lot of shame associated with getting punished. Even when my siblings would get punished, I'd go somewhere where I could hear, like, the sound of, like, the cat's paw hitting them, because it really upset me. Even to this day, if, like, a kid is getting spanked, like, I just have to, like, leave where I can't hear, like, the sound of, like, impact, because it really bothers me. And so stuff like that, I guess, I don't know.
Well, no, that reminds me, that's legit, because you're a secondary victim to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably also contributed to some of the PTSD you were dealing with. Like, that is, and if it's bad enough if it happens one time, but if it happens a lot, it is, you're a secondary victim to that.
No, I can't even watch it on TV. Like, if there's, like, a scene where, like, a kid is getting spanked, like, I will fast forward through it. Cannot do it. And I know some people, it's going to be clear, like, not all forms of that kind of punishment are bad. But I think that the ones that I think are more acceptable are the ones where they're not trying to, like, hurt their kids.
Yeah.
You know, people who are going at it to be like, I'm inflicting pain so my child will learn. Like, I don't think that's healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes my nephew will get, like, a little, kind of, like, a little tap. But, like, it's a tap and he doesn't even cry. It's just because he has to, like, hey, move, like, stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Minor correction and not, like, not abusive. I think we all can tell if it's when it kind of tips into being abusive, feeling abusive. Except as a kid, it's hard to distinguish. You don't know. You don't know if you're being raised in it. Yeah.
And like, there are so many easier ways to do it. Like, instead of like slapping a kid's hand, you can just like hold it and be like, hey, let's talk about that. Or like I said with my nephew, like he never gets a punishment that like upsets him. Usually if like he does something that's naughty, they'll sit him down and like, they'll try to explain what's going on to him. And then like, they'll like, he's little enough that he like pulls hair and stuff. So like, they'll kind of grab him and they'll like be like, move really quickly. But like, they've never been like, yeah, we're going to try to make him feel pain so he learns. Like, that kid has never known violence from his parents' hands, and he probably will never. I can confidently say he will never, because, like, and he's not a bad kid because of it. I don't know. Sorry, I digress.
Like, no, that's like, not digressing. No, yeah, that's absolutely on topic.
And Grace, I wanted to tell you that I've never experienced what you've experienced or anything like it. Robin has, but mm-hmm. I believe everything you're saying.
Thank you.
So just wanted to tell you that. And we thank you. We wish we could talk with you longer.
Yeah.
It's been so fascinating. And we hope that it's been in some way a little bit therapeutic for you.
Yeah.
We're grateful for you sharing your story. You are on your way. And so I'm so happy for you. And I just wish you lots of, you know, goodness for your journey.
Thank you.
Of course. And I hope you keep running into guides who will help you along the way, whether that's people or, you know, things that you're learning or your sweet little kitty or, you know, whatever. I just hope that you just continue to run into guides who will help you.
Listeners, you can learn more about cults, including religious cults, at the Freedom of Mind Resource Center, which is linked in the show notes. The center helps people who are trying to leave cults and provides information for those who just want to learn more about them. Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.